Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We are recording this at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 5th of July. Thousands of mourners attend the funeral of 12 Palestinians killed during Israel's offensive in the West Bank city of Jenin. Ukraine accuses Russia of placing objects resembling explosives at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And three Catalan separatist politicians move a step closer to extradition to Spain. Also in the podcast...
The football way has always been, we'll do what everybody else has done and we won't change it. And so to go into a club that actually wants you to be innovative is really exciting.
English professional football gets its first ever woman manager. Hours after Israeli troops ended their raid on the Jenin refugee camp, the first funerals have been held for the 12 Palestinians killed. Mourners reportedly refused to allow leaders from the Palestinian Authority to attend out of anger at their perceived failure to help during the offensive. The two-day raid, the biggest in the occupied West Bank for years, involved more than 1,000 Israeli troops as well as drones, airstrikes on densely populated areas and armoured bulldozers ripping up streets. One Israeli soldier was killed. Israel said the raid was intended to target militants behind a recent surge in terror attacks. Just before we recorded this podcast, I got the latest from our correspondent in Jenin, Anna Foster.
This is a scene of cleanup in this particular part of Jenin, just outside of the refugee camp, where we saw burning tyres, broken glass. That's all being swept away. The roads are being hosed down. And in fact, in the camp itself, people are trying to deal with things like overturned cars, hulks of twisted metal in these narrow streets. A lot of the shops and businesses are closed here today. There's a general strike in this area in solidarity with those Palestinians who lost their lives in that operation over the last few days. An interesting mood as well. For many, it is a sense of relief. For some of those who actually fled while the fighting was going on, they've returned today. For some, this feels like a victory because some of those militant groups have said that they still have weapons and they plan to regroup. And I think for some people as well, there's a sense that this will happen again. And of course, this is what the Israeli leadership have said, that if these networks do begin to grow in strength, that they will not hesitate to do another military operation of this size.
And what is Israel saying that this operation has achieved?
Well, Israel considers this to be a success. They've been displaying this morning some of the weaponry that they confiscated. They said that they wanted to send a very strong message that these attacks would not be tolerated. So I think they feel confident that for now they have managed to dismantle some of that infrastructure. And in terms of repercussions, there were some rockets fired from Gaza into Israel this morning. And as a result, there were IDF airstrikes on targets in the Gaza Strip. But I think for now, it feels like a tentative calm. And of course, these are areas that I think you can say really are outside now of the control of the Palestinian Authority, because particularly this younger generation don't see the PA as improving their lives in the occupied West Bank in any way. And those tensions will continue. And there's really, I don't think, any clear sign of how a path, some kind of course will be steered through that, because the Palestinian Authority leadership, they are aging now. They, at the moment, are not going anywhere. Also, if you look at who future Palestinian leaders might be, you know, various of them are in Israeli jails at the moment. So I think it's very difficult to work out how some of those issues might be resolved.
Anna Foster in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Three members of the European Parliament who fled the Spanish region of Catalonia after organising an independence vote have lost an appeal against being stripped of their parliamentary immunity. One of the EU's highest courts said it rejected all the pleas made by the three, including the former Catalan president Carles Puigdemont. The ruling confirms the European Parliament's decision to waive their immunity in March 2021. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, told us more about the three MEPs.
So Carles Puigdemont was the head of the Catalan region at the time that this vote on independence took place in 2017, very much the figurehead, well recognised internationally. And then there are two ministers of his former government, Toni Comín and Clara Ponsatí, and they also fled. They all three were initially charged with sedition because the Spanish courts said that the vote was illegal, whereas they got out of the country. A number of other Catalan independence figures got prosecuted and put in jail until they were pardoned eventually by the Spanish government. So this is a very significant case. They say that basically they're being politically persecuted, and they were elected as MEPs after this. So in 2019 for Carles Puigdemont and Toni Comín, and 2020 for Clara Ponsatí, and they've been trying to claim immunity. The court said that their cases in Spain predated their election as members of the European Parliament, and it rejected some of their other arguments, such as the fact that the head of one of the commissions may have not been impartial.
And does this ruling mean that they are likely to be extradited to Spain?
Well, that it's certainly a step in that way, and the Spanish government has welcomed it on that regard. But it's not over yet. And Carles Puigdemont made this very clear. He said that basically that if this case is not overturned, it would be basically a threat to political dissent in Europe. So they're very defiant. And Clara Ponsatí also said it was a difficult day, but that basically the only way to stop the persecution of the independence cause is to push on until Catalonia gets independence. We'll now have to see. Basically, the Spanish judge who's in charge of this process may well reissue European arrest warrants, but they are appealing the decision to lift their immunity in the very highest court of the European Union, the Court of Justice. That will take several months to run its course.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt. Since it invaded Ukraine, Russia has repeatedly invoked the threat of nuclear conflict. Military analysts have generally played down the likelihood of Russia using an actual nuclear weapon. But there is concern it might trigger some kind of radiation incident at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which it has occupied for most of the war. Now, Ukraine says it has intelligence that Russian troops have placed objects resembling explosives on at least two power units at the plant. Ukraine's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yevheny Tsymbaliuk, told the BBC it is very worrying.
We don't need another Chernobyl in Europe. It's absolutely obvious. And if Russians will continue their provocations, it could be like this. We believe that international atomic energy should play its role and should evaluate situation on the ground because they have a mission there.
The Kremlin has said the situation at the plant is tense and that it fears Ukraine may carry out an attack there. Our correspondent Gordon Carrera is following developments from the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
This detail came from President Zelensky in his overnight address, citing his own military intelligence service, suggesting that on two of the reactor plants, there's a number of them at the site, it's the largest site of its type in Europe, but on two of them, reactors 3 and 4, that there'd been something which they suggested resembled explosives placed on the roofs of those. Now, we've not been able to independently verify that at the BBC, but it's the latest in a series of alarming warnings, which have been coming for some time about possible sabotage plans by Russia. Now, Russia, of course, has denied this and has suggested it's Ukraine that's planning to launch missiles tonight, potentially at this site. The Ukrainians clearly believe that this could be a provocation that the Russians may end up claiming if something does happen that it was Ukrainian missiles and so on. Certainly there have been these kind of warnings for some time. They're not new, but they have been growing in intensity in the last few days. And it was noticeable that, again, the Ukrainians were reporting claims that Russia had told some of the staff to leave by today.
Now, of course, we saw the region nearby devastated by that explosion at the dam. What would the effects of an explosion at the nuclear power plant be?
Well, that's very hard to say. There have been worries, actually, that the cooling process breaking down because of the loss of power to the plant and the loss of water after that dam explosion. And the IAEA have been monitoring the situation closely, and they've been saying the power has been on and off again at various points, and they've been trying to keep people in place to be able to monitor it. The worst case scenario, if there was some kind of explosion there and radioactive material was released, you'd have what's known as a kind of dirty bomb in military or in security terms, which is where you have a localised dispersal of radioactive material due to an explosion. Now, that's very different from, if you like, a reactor meltdown or something much more serious, which would spread radioactive material much further, but it would still potentially be serious in that localised area.
Gordon Carrera, our security correspondent, talking to me from Kiev. Throughout the war in Ukraine, one of Russia's strongest supporters has been Cuba. The Russian defense minister was recently quoted saying Cuba was Russia's most important ally in Latin America. In return, Havana has recently received help to tackle its crippling fuel crisis. But some Cubans are wary of getting too close to Moscow. From Havana, Will Grant reports.
Driving has long been a luxury in Cuba, where most can't afford or obtain a car. At the root of Cuba's problems is a potent combination of several factors: government mismanagement, the global economic downturn, and the decades-long US embargo.
I'm just driving past a line now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 15 cars waiting for the petrol station to open. It's a situation that has pushed the residents of Havana and actually across Cuba to the brink of despair. And of course, the current fuel crisis in Cuba needs to be set into context, alongside other significant challenges in food security, inflation, blackouts. For the beleaguered Cuban people, it seems the island is just lurching from crisis to crisis.
To alleviate the situation, the island's leadership recently signed new accords with Russian businesses in sectors from tourism and agriculture to energy. Russian companies received some major concessions to revive decrepit tourist infrastructure, like the decaying beach resort of Tarará, as well as an obsolete sugar mill in Santi Spiritus province.
Y presidente de la República de Cuba, Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez.
The Cuban government also hopes Russian firms will supply around 30,000 barrels of crude oil a day to the island, which cash-strapped socialist ally Venezuela can no longer provide. But Cuba's leading independent economist, Omar Eveleni, says closer Russian ties are only a short-term fix.
While you're putting out fires on several fronts, Russia has come in to shore up that unstable situation. But the problem lies in the medium term, because these aren't Soviet companies giving out government credits. They are private Russian firms who will demand a return on their investment. Whether it will involve further sacrifices for Cuban families, because we'll have to pay back those credits, or if there'll be another Putin figure in charge who'll forgive the debt one day. We simply don't know.
Amid the war in Ukraine, Cuba's communist leadership remains resolute in its support for Moscow and President Putin. Following the Russians' visit to Cuba, a top-level Cuban delegation recently travelled to Moscow in return. Without a doubt, said the Russian Defence Minister Sergei Shoigu, Cuba has been and continues to be Russia's most important ally in Latin America. But economist Omar Eveleni insists Russia alone isn't the answer to Cuba's woes.
Cuba has always had another country to sponsor it, and it's been terrible as that country eventually leaves. You can't depend on a single market. I think Cuba needs to take those resources and make its own production strategy, one in which I think the small and medium-sized private businesses, Cuban businesses, should play a key role.
Like the island's classic cars, lined up at the petrol pumps, the Cuban Revolution itself also dates to the 1950s. And both are now running on fumes, struggling to maintain momentum without a significant overhaul in the years ahead.
Will Grant, reporting from Havana. And still to come in the Global News podcast... Flooding in China leaves 15 people dead while others are rescued.
Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast from the BBC World Service ranking the best African players.
This guy is recognised as the best in the world.
Teams.
The ball coming, turn, boom.
And the biggest moments in African football.
The whole world remembers that.
Remember that, yeah.
It's not just African fans.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In May, a 95-year-old woman with dementia died after being tasered by police in Australia. She had allegedly been carrying a steak knife around her nursing home. The police officer involved now faces three charges, including assault, but he failed to appear at a scheduled court hearing. Phil Mercer has been following the story.
This is a case involving senior constable Christian White. He appeared before a magistrate in the town of Cooma. This is about 100 kilometres south of the national capital, Canberra, via a video link. Now, the magistrate was pretty unhappy that the senior constable wasn't in court in person, but we do know that this police officer is facing three charges, including recklessly causing grievous bodily harm. Now, this carries a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison, and it relates to an incident at a nursing home in Cooma in the middle of May, where a great-grandmother was struck with a police stun gun. That apparently she had one hand on a walking frame, in the other hand was a serrated steak knife. She was repeatedly told to drop the knife. She didn't and was tasered by a police officer.
Yeah, I mean, this case made news around the world. What's been the impact in Australia itself?
Well, the family of Claire Nowland, 95 years of age, she died a week later. She was struck by the taser, the stun gun. She fell over. She banged her head. She suffered a fractured skull and never recovered. Her family want the legal process to answer one critical question. Why was a frail elderly woman weighing just 43 kilograms, barely 5 foot tall, suffering from dementia, struck with a stun gun used allegedly by an experienced police officer? Of course, in criminal cases, invariably, there's more than one side of the story. So the job of the court here in Australia is to try to get to the truth. And this case returns to court on the 6th of September.
Phil Mercer there in Sydney. For 2 days in a row, the world's air temperature has hit a new high, reaching an average of 17.18 degrees Celsius on Tuesday, up from 17.01 on Monday. One of the countries that suffered from record heat waves this year is China. The north of the country has been particularly badly affected. But now torrential rains are wreaking havoc further south. 15 people have died in flooding in Chongqing, with dramatic footage showing buildings collapsing into swollen rivers. Well, that is the sound of people desperately clinging to ropes as they are rescued from the raging waters. I heard more from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Will Leonardo.
China is no stranger to these extreme weather conditions, but this rainy season appears to be particularly brutal. The damage is centred in western China, including the city of Chongqing, as you mentioned, and its surrounding countryside, where for days now we've seen footage, some of which you just heard, of rivers, including the Yangtze, overflowing their banks and widespread destruction. One video showed a large multi-storey building collapsing under the pressure of a torrent of water. In others, you see cars floating away, submerged roads and residential blocks. This is now the first confirmation of deaths from the authorities. 15 people killed, as you said, and four more missing as officials race to rescue those trapped. And there's been thousands of evacuation orders. The latest reports say a railway bridge in Chongqing has collapsed. And of course, this is all adding up to a huge repair bill. Damage caused in one area of Chongqing alone is already estimated to have cost more than $30 million.
Repair bill, but I guess the rescue comes before that. What are the authorities doing?
Indeed, the central government has been sending in rescue teams and has made more than $40 million worth of extra funding available. And these workers have been publishing videos of their operations. You know, one of the most dramatic shows a couple standing up through their sunroof as floodwaters race around their car before rescuers use a drone and a crane to winch them to safety. Others show residents being escorted out of flooded buildings. President Xi Jinping has intervened to send a strong message to authorities to give what he called top priority to ensuring people's safety and minimise damage. And he's also ordered government departments to better coordinate and improve early warnings and forecasts. But as you say, the focus right now is on saving lives.
And as I was saying, China's also experienced pretty bad heat waves. I mean, what is the long-term prospect here?
Yeah, so these floods in Chongqing are only a small part of extreme conditions that have hit China this year, including high temperatures. Neighbouring Sichuan province has been battered by heavy rain for weeks. Almost 500,000 people reported to be affected there, especially in hard-to-reach mountainous areas. In the capital, Beijing, there are warnings for people to stay inside as temperatures climb above 35 degrees Celsius. And flood warnings are also in place in northern regions, in Inner Mongolia, Liaoning and Jilin. You know, every year there's climate damage, but these combined extreme conditions are rare. And China's meteorologists are saying that there's little respite coming in the next few weeks. They've said to expect multiple natural disasters through July.
Our Asia Pacific editor, Will Leonardo. South Korea says it respects the UN nuclear watchdog's approval of the Japanese plan to discharge treated water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean. It comes a day after the IAEA said that the water used to cool the damaged reactors would have a negligible impact. South Korea, like China, had been strongly opposed to the plan. Dr. Charles Castro, an expert on nuclear safety from Atlanta in the US, led an international team that helped when the disaster at Fukushima happened in 2011. James Copnell asked him why there's such a problem with the water in the first place.
During the nuclear accident in 2011, the plant was cooled by water that was contaminated inside the reactors. It had many different isotopes, radioactive isotopes within that water, and that water was stored on site rather than being released to the ocean. Ultimately, there was a cleanup system installed, and that cleanup system took out all of the most hazardous radioisotopes.
And so this water is now going to be released into the Pacific. The International Atomic Energy Agency saying it will have only a negligible impact on the environment. Is that right, do you think?
I think that's right. I think it will not be even measurable, let alone negligible. Studies show that the tritium will be absorbed by normal water within meters of the injection point.
Have we had a release on this scale? That's to say, are we projecting, guessing, estimating based on much smaller examples of a release of water? Or has something like this been done in the past?
Actually, much larger releases have been done in the past. Fukushima released much larger amounts of tritium in the past under normal operations, under normal plant operations. They released about 50 terabecquerels per year of tritium. And in this release, it'll be about 22 terabecquerels.
Why then is there such opposition from some people and environmental groups in Japan, from some of Japan's neighbors as well, Pacific Islands, South Korea, others? Right. Why are people so concerned?
The Pacific Islands have released much larger amounts of this themselves, and also mainland countries on the Pacific have released much larger amounts. And of course, there's a political dimension to it. Japan has some unfriendly neighbors. And there's clearly in any country with tritium, there's a perception and fear problem. There's not a health problem with tritium. In 2010, I led a major task force to determine if more regulation was needed for tritium. And we concluded through much research and evaluation that tritium is not a significant health hazard and it's not a significant environmental hazard.
Expand on the politics a bit. Is this, for example, South Korea's tensions with Japan? Is that a big part of it? Or are you thinking of something else?
I think of China and South Korea. You know, they have reasons to second guess or challenge Japan in this area. Both of those countries have released far more. Some articles you'll read online or studies you'll read says some of those countries release 6.5 times the amount of tritium that will be released in the Fukushima water.
Charles Castro, who helped with Japan's nuclear disaster back in 2011. Researchers poking around in elephant dung have discovered that, like humans, these enormous animals may vary what they eat for dinner each night. Our science correspondent Helen Briggs has the details.
Most of an elephant's day is spent chomping through a vast amount of grasses, leaves, fruits and roots. but the precise mix of plants an elephant eats was previously unknown, partly because of the perils of getting close to one in the wild. A US team made this discovery by analysing plant DNA in the dung of wild elephants in Kenya. They found individual diets were far more varied than expected, even among family members who foraged together. The scientists think this means individuals choose different selections of hundreds of plants to suit their specific needs, especially when pregnant or feeding their young. This knowledge could be useful in the conservation of wild elephants, which can come into conflict with people when raiding crops.
Helen Briggs. Now to a moment of English footballing history. For the first time, a woman has been appointed manager of a professional men's team. League Two side Forest Green Rovers say Hannah Dingley is the natural choice to take over the post. She currently heads their academy. When she joined the club 4 years ago, Dingley said she could see that Rovers think differently.
The football way has always been, we'll do what everybody else has done and we won't change it, and quite slow to pick up new ideas, really. So to go into a club that actually wants you to be innovative, try different things, is really exciting and gives you massive potential.
I've been hearing more about Hannah Dingley from World Service sports presenter Isaac Fannin.
She's used to making history in English football. She became the only woman to manage a men's English football academy at Forest Green Rovers back in 2019. She was born and raised in West Wales and she has a UEFA Pro licence, previously worked at Burton Albion, so plenty of experience in the men's game.
Yeah, it comes as we're seeing female referees in the men's game. We're seeing the rise of women's football, certainly on TV here. So quite a significant moment.
Indeed, yeah. And when I woke up this morning and I saw this news, I wasn't surprised that it was Forest Green Rovers that did this, because as a club, they are quite forward thinking, as she said. Dale Vince, the owner, is a green energy industrialist. He bought the club back in 2010 and has completely changed their fortunes. They're the first club to become carbon neutral in the world, the first vegan football club in the world. And he has talked himself about football needing to get more diversity, both on race and in gender. And so, yeah, this is not a surprise.
And how significant is it in the global context?
Yeah, so I think basketball was the sport that was probably the closest to potentially having a woman in a high-ranking position. Becky Hammon is a name that some of our listeners might be familiar with. She coached with the San Antonio Spurs for a number of years, had a number of interviews for head coaching roles across the NBA, didn't get them, and ended up going to coach the Las Vegas Aces to the women's NBA title last season. So she was the name which we thought would become the first woman to coach in a big league. But we've seen in basketball, Liz Mills in Africa actually coached the Kenyan basketball team. Last year, she was coaching at the ABC Fighters for the Basketball Africa League. A name to look out for in football in future is Emma Hayes. She is the Chelsea women's coach. She has been linked to a number of roles in men's football, but she says she's pretty happy at Chelsea women coaching some of the best women's players in the world, like Sam Kerr, who will be watching in a few weeks' time.
Isaac Fannin. And that's nearly all from us for now. But before we go, a quick request from Nick Miles.
Hi, just a quick one to thank everybody who's already sent in their thoughts about artificial intelligence. But please do keep them coming. Just a reminder, early next week, we are recording a special global news podcast looking at the opportunities and the challenges presented by artificial intelligence. We want you to tell us, what are your hopes and fears about AI now and in the future? Just send us a short email, a sentence or two will do, or better still, a voice note starting with your name and where you're from to the normal address. globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We will have a panel of experts on hand to answer many of your questions at King's College London next week. Thanks a lot.
The Global News Podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by George Baines and produced by Tracy Gordon. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.